May it please the court, Mr. Russell. This is a most troubling case involving the critical relationship between the courts and members of the bar who appear and advocate on behalf of their clients. When an attorney makes false and racially charged statements about a judge to clients and third parties, the public's confidence in the administration of justice is undermined, and the attorney's character and fitness as a lawyer must be questioned. In 2014, respondent represented an inmate in connection with a federal petition for a writ of habeas corpus. On September 2, 2014, Judge Fernando Gaitan, a senior United States District Court judge for the Western District of Missouri, denied the petition. 10 days later, on September 12, 2014, respondent sent an email to his client's spouse where he addressed Judge Gaitan's decision and in which he called Judge Gaitan a puppet, used racial slurs directed at Judge Gaitan, used an expletive to describe Judge Gaitan and the judge's decision in his client's case. Respondent then turned his attention to this court's opinion in Rentschler versus Nixon, a unanimous 2010 decision written by then Chief Justice William Price. Respondent stated in the email that the Rentschler case was decided by an idiot. At the end of the email, respondent directs his client's wife to read the email to his client, who was incarcerated at the time at the Crossroads Correctional Center. On October 10, 2014, respondent's client wrote to Judge Gaitan and attached a copy of the email to his letter. Judge Gaitan then notified the OCDC of the email by a letter dated November 4, 2014, and an investigative file was opened. On January 13, 2015, as part of his response to the OCDC, respondent attached a letter of apology that he had sent to Judge Gaitan that same day. In that letter, respondent admitted that his moral character was poor. The decision by the disciplinary hearing panel found that respondent violated Rule 4-8.2 by knowingly making false statements regarding the qualifications and integrity of both Judge Gaitan and former Chief Justice Price. The panel also found that the respondent violated this court's anti-discrimination rule, Rule 4-8.4G, by manifesting by his words and conduct towards Judge Gaitan bias and prejudice based upon race. Two members of the panel recommended the respondent be indefinitely suspended with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 1 year. One member of the panel chair Susan Applequist, believed that the misconduct was so outrageous and the consequences or potential consequences so severe that disbarment was the appropriate remedy.
So what were the consequences? I mean, there's the statements being made could be reprehensible. However, was there any intent to threaten? Was there any feeling of any threat to the good Judge Gaitan? Or is there any consequence that was could be demonstrated of the exercise of however ill-advised of these comments?
Judge Feilman, there was no threat directed at Judge Gaitan by the email or by his conduct. Nevertheless, both rules 4-8.2 as well as 4-8.4G, the anti-discrimination rule, speak to the harm to the administration of justice by these types of words, this type of conduct, when it's directed towards the judiciary. And the panel specifically found that and I'll quote here, in talking about the harm to the administration of justice done by this conduct, the panel stated, the enormity of his choice of words is harshened by the fact that his client was in a penitentiary. The effect that this language would have on the people in the prison environment can only be imagined. Potential harm is what's necessary, and I think it's clear here that type of conduct directed into that penitentiary does create problem for and harm to the administration of justice.
Now, what was the discipline to Buzz Westfall in the case in which he said one of the judges in the Court of Appeals was acting intellectually, was intellectually dishonest? Or
right.
Was it like a reprimand?
Right. There's two cases this court has decided of note, the Westfall case and the Madison case that addressed violations of 4-8.2. In Westfall, the attorney claimed that Judge Carroll's opinion was illogical, that he was less than honest, and that he arrived at a decision that he personally liked. The court found a violation of 4-8.2 and assessed a reprimand against Mr. Westfall, in that case, 1991. 2009, the court takes up the Madison case. Mr. Madison made various forms of criticisms directed at a judge in Jackson County. He was found to have violated 4-8.2 as well, also found to have violated 4-8.4D, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, and he was sanctioned with indefinite suspension with leave to apply for reinstatement in 6 months. I think what sets this case apart from both Westfall and Madison, as well as the cases from other jurisdictions that we cite in our brief, is that we're talking now about the anti-discrimination rule 4-8.4G, which this court has never taken up. And I think the conduct in violation of that rule goes to character and fitness. In both Westfall and Madison, there was no indication that the court was thinking character and fitness when it found violations of 4-8.2. Here, I think the conduct is so egregious, so outrageous, and so abhorrent that it goes to the respondent's character and fitness to continue to practice law in the state of Missouri. And
now,
so,
how does this attorney discriminate? How is he discriminating in using this language?
Under 4-8.4G, it's by referencing race in describing Judge Gaitan, and using a racial slur in describing Judge Gaitan in representing his client. Note that it's in representing the client that the conduct has to occur under 4-8.4G, and that is exactly what occurred here.
Can we consider the angry and disruptive comments he made in preparing for the hearing when the disciplinary hearing panel said they would not, they would dismiss the charge based on that?
Judge Smith, there were a couple of voicemails that the respondent left for me. There was conduct directed towards Susan Applequist, the chair of the panel. Those were, at least the voicemails were put into evidence. Frankly, I think the 8.4D violation flows from the email, not from those voicemails. I think, if anything, those voicemails reflect aggravating conduct, not necessarily a separate violation under 8.4D.
And I wanted to know that, and also just our authority, where the majority, it says the majority of the panel believes the evidence isn't sufficient on that, and those allegations should be dismissed, then those then aren't
well, it's
for
interesting.
Us as a separate allegation, but rather you say as
well, the information does evidence. Charge 8.4D based on the email. The panel decision finds no violation of 8.4D based on the voicemails. But really what I'm trying to circle back to is the fact that the voicemail, the email is in fact conduct that I think violates 8.4D, conduct
and you asserted in support of the other violation as aggravating evidence.
Correct. I mean, that's what happened in
Madison.
Is
that lack of cooperation or?
Well, to me, the aggravator is yes, the disruption of the disciplinary proceeding. I will say that I think a respondent who was not represented at the panel hearing, Mr. Russell entered during the briefing period, I think there was a basic lack of understanding on his part as to Rule 5 procedures, and he thought somehow he was going to be having a discussion with me regarding the sanction that I thought was appropriate. So so he leaves these voicemails. Clearly, I'm a represented person here, and he should have been talking to Mr. Rath, the special representative, but the voicemails speak for themselves. I think it is an aggravator. I think his conduct at the hearing is also an aggravator, but not necessarily a violation of 8.4D.
It seems to be relevant to whether he can conform his conduct to appropriate conduct and whether going forward he would be able to do so.
I agree, Judge Chief Justice Breckenridge, which kind of segues into the Asperger's reference in the brief at the hearing. Actually, even in the email, there's a reference made to Asperger's. He apparently was suffering from Asperger's. I frankly, as the informant, am a little bit uncertain as to how that's being used here, whether it's to describe and explain the voicemails he left for me, or to describe and explain the emails that he sent to the subject of the case. I take it that it was his description and explanation for why he left these angry voicemails for me.
But was any medical evidence presented to support
that? The next point is, there's never affirmative defense raised under 5.285 for the Asperger's. There's never any medical testimony establishing that he suffers from it, or there's a causal nexus, or that it's under some sort of successful treatment, and the likelihood of this type of occurrence.
And no allegation of Tourette syndrome or anything like that?
None.
But he did say he was an alcoholic, and so how does that play into it?
I think it was something that was in his past, I believe, Judge Russell, and I don't think it was part of this case. In their brief, they also mention a medical condition, hemochromatosis, which is a genetic disorder.
He testified he's a recovering alcoholic.
Yes. Okay. I don't think that was raised as any kind of issue at the hearing. The only thing he said he would like to be considered is Asperger's at the hearing, only, by the way, when Kevin Rapp, the special representative, asked him, do you want the panel and the court to consider Asperger's? And he finally, after some back and forth where he thought, I don't know, he just misunderstood the question and finally said, yes, I would like it to be considered. But again, there's no basis under 5.285 for that to be considered.
But you're not saying it's not relevant evidence, even if it doesn't meet 5.285. Like, if you are an alcoholic, that's relevant, whether it's always been relevant evidence.
I think it is relevant that he has an alcoholism problem.
And so would be if you had some mental issues, even if they don't provide the formal defense that we've set out, wouldn't it be?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a reason why 5.285 exists. He may have suffered from it, but I think there has to be some scintilla of evidence to establish that causal connection through medical testimony. Yeah, you may suffer from it. Where's the causal nexus to say that that condition is what caused this email to be sent? It's just lacking totally here. So, yeah, it's a condition he suffered from. The homochromatosis is a condition he apparently suffers from, but I see no connection between that and the thrust of the main misconduct here, which is the abhorrent and racist email that he sends to his client that then gets distributed into this prison community. I guess I'll just save my last 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court.
Mr. President.
There's absolutely no evidence that this email was distributed in any way inside the prison community other than going to his client. There was no intention or thought that this email, which contained a racial slur, would ever be sent to Judge Gaetan. The intended audience in this situation for the email was his client.
Well, but he sent it to his client's wife, not to his client.
Well,
it wasn't
privileged. He couldn't send it to his client because his client was incarcerated, and so he had to.
And you can't send anything to your client?
No.
You couldn't go see his client?
And that was, let me back up just a second. The way this thing came about was there was an email from the client's wife to Mr. Henry inquiring about what was happening with the case. And at that point, he responded to her with this email, in which he was obviously upset that Judge Gaetan had taken about 20 months to decide something and got off on all that. But there's no indication that this email has been distributed to anybody other than Judge Gaetan and the client himself in the
and his spouse.
Yeah, and
you're not saying it was okay to send that.
Absolutely not. And he recognized that when he apologized. There wasn't any. As soon as it came to his attention that it had gotten to Judge Gaetan, why, he immediately apologized. And we cite the case to the court of Mr. Westfall, and this court spent some time talking about his statements, and excuse me, the judge, or excuse me, Mr. Westfall characterized Judge Carroll's conduct, specifically referred to him by name, talked about his motivation, about his integrity, and this court found that respondent's language, at the very least, implies the judge's conduct exhibited dishonesty and lack of integrity, and without corroborative evidence, he accused Judge Carroll of deliberate dishonesty, of purposefully ignoring the law to achieve his own personal goals, that he altered the statute and its interpretation, and that later, in a private moment before the disciplinary hearing panel, Mr. Westfall saw Judge Carroll, apologized to him, and the court in that circumstance found the appropriate remedy was a reprimand.
He did apologize, but can't we take into consideration, or shouldn't we take into consideration, his behavior at the disciplinary hearing panel and the emails he sent prior to that to show whether he's really remorseful, whether he really understands why this was improper, and why he really understands what his conduct has to be in the future?
I didn't find any place where the emails are put into evidence. Nothing in my record that I ever received that shows what the emails are. And I have to tell you that I really kind of want to apologize a little for my brief, because I got agitated in this case when the first thing I read was that the special representative says to the hearing panel, "We have deliberately made this information as vague as possible to protect the judge. And our intention is to use whatever evidence that we put on and then conform the pleadings to the evidence." Well, that may be okay for the OCDC's side of the thing, but that's a pretty unsatisfactory situation for respondents to find themselves in,
if a competent lawyer wanted to object to that, he certainly could have. Or he could have hired counsel to represent him either way.
I would have probably not remembered, but I wasn't there. And that's where that went. But that's not the way the railroad ought to run. The charging document is the charging document, and then you've got to be in position to object to things that are not relevant to the charge.
You would have been better off if you were there, but given that, how he might have anger management issues, is he seeking help, or is there any remedial aspect?
He has, since we started into this process, gone to and completed an anger management program in St. Louis, and I think that particularly has some application to people with obsessive compulsive disorder. But there is no question about the propriety of his remarks. They're improper, inappropriate, no question about
it. Has the remedial action, the remedial efforts been communicated with Mr. Pratzel, and some sense of correction to this kind of behavior?
Well, to me, the great remedial aspect of this is that once he learned that it had gone to the judge, he immediately apologized. This court has put considerable weight on apologies. First off, on Mr. Westfall, the master noted it. In the Carroll Coe case, and again with Westfall and Coe, who's the audience? Who's the purported audience? Unlike this one, where it's his client, in Westfall, the audience is the TV5 viewing area in St. Louis. And that's who the message was sent to on two different occasions in which he made these statements. In Coe, the audience was Judge Stevens and the other people inside the courtroom. The statements in the Coe case essentially are that the judge is biased against her, that he is unfair, that he won't be fair, that he's not treating them equally. Mr. Prantl wants to talk about the Madison case. My client has no prior discipline history, zero. If he's got anger management problems, they sure haven't exhibited themselves in such a fashion to cause somebody to seek discipline against him. Madison had prior discipline for a felony assault, received a reprimand. He had at least three admonitions by the time he started writing letters to the judges on the Jackson County Court, accusing them of being part of an evil empire, of being racist, impugning the integrity of the judges. At one point said that one of the judges had soiled her robes by her conduct. I mean, it's pretty egregious stuff. And it's also has to do with race because they call the judge a racist. And I suggest to you that, well, using a slur is bad. When you're talking about a judge, if you accuse a judge of being a racist, that is a pretty significant accusation. That goes to the heart of the judge's ability to hear a case. Are they handling their cases based on what they hear in the courtroom?
Well, but
what
you
the
would
law
have
is
a right, not, I mean, we impose sanctions there, but there could be times when you, as an attorney representing your client, if you think a strike of a juror was racially based or improper, it's your obligation to
sure
raise it. That's different than using a racial slur as here, for which there's never an appropriate time.
I would agree. It's not appropriate.
Yeah.
But in Madison, there isn't anything that's appropriate about that either. It's one of the most egregious set of facts I've seen. The judge ended
what
up...
What was the judge's response to the apology?
There has been none, as far as I know. I don't think there has been any. This is a situation, there's no...
As far as calling a judge a racist, I remember when Senator Thomas F. Eagleton was swearing in Judge Cahill as a district judge, the first African-American district judge, that Senator Eagleton was very direct and clear about some of the judges that preceded Judge Cahill on the bench. And it was an open court.
He
made assertions.
Yeah, I wasn't there, so I'm not familiar with that.
I was.
But if you look at this situation, I got juiced up on this idea that you could charge somebody in such a fashion not to tell them what the facts are. And I don't think we ought to be involved in that type of gamesmanship when we're in this type of proceeding. This is not a time for gotchas and that sort of
thing. Was he confused as to what it was about?
I'm sorry?
Was there any confusion on his part as to why he'd been called in for the hearing?
To some extent, yes. Particularly as it has to do with the voicemails. Under Rule 511, they're supposed to give you the statements that you have. Well, they didn't give them to him at any time until they came into court and came into the hearing and say, here they are. There's no effort to amend the information to say that there was something improper about that. Well, that got me going, and I unfortunately I would have to say I apologize for the nature of my brief because I got wound up and completely forgot to include the black letter law, essentially, that says disbarment is reserved for gross and severe misconduct where it is demonstrable that the attorney can no longer practice before the bar. No prior history, no client harm involved in this at all.
And no subsequent history? Nothing since then? Been abusive since this incident?
If it exists, I certainly don't know about it, Your Honor. And there's been certainly no allegation from the other side that that has been the case.
But what in the record would show us that your client can conduct himself appropriately in practicing law and with others when he does not appear to have been able to do so during this proceeding?
Mr. Pratzel talked about the Asperger's, and he has been diagnosed with Asperger's. They went into the Asperger's with him. It's not a defense under 5.285 because it wasn't raised, it wasn't pleaded. This man responded and admitted every single thing with which he was charged. He did not.
The question to you was, what should cause us to believe, even though he admitted his behavior, what causes us to believe that he's able to go forward and not act in the same manner?
At this point, Judge, it's a single, isolated incident. And unless there's something that indicates that it is not.
Well, it was his conduct during, in response to Mr. Pratzel, during the hearing. So the racial slur may have been a single incident, but his conduct during the hearing certainly is significant as to whether it could be isolated or an ongoing concern.
The panel specifically found that he was not disruptive to the panel. Not, is he the picture of an ability to control himself at all times? No.
Well, they found that he made agitated, vulgar, didn't they, and angry calls and used agitated, vulgar language, but that was not sufficient to rise to the level of a violation, but that he did.
Yeah. Well, and there was also an allegation that was made by the special rep that he disrupted the.
Okay.
And they found out that
okay.
he did
Thank
not
you.
Do that.
Thank you.
So it's a question.
I'm looking at the disciplinary hearing decision, and it says at the disciplinary hearing, it's the allegation was that he was angry and vulgar.
And I think they found it.
Okay.
On page 4, they found that, but they didn't find the separate disruptive fact. But it doesn't that causes concern that in light of the prior comments and the nature of the letter and the anger and vulgarity of the letter, and then he behaves that way at the hearing, why would we not expect he may continue to do so? What in this record gives us reason to think that would not occur?
He had the good sense, first off, to apologize.
Has he apologized to the panel or to Mr. Pratzel or other people?
We have apologized certainly in our brief to everybody in that regard. But in every case cited by the informant from out of this court, where there's an apology, there's either a reprimand or an admonition.
The record shows that he apologized to Judge Gaitan, but did he apologize to Judge Price?
He didn't even know who Judge Price was, unfortunately. He didn't know. He talked about that case as if he was on top of it, and he wasn't.
So he didn't apologize to Judge Price?
He didn't mention the name, did he? He said the case.
No, the name was never mentioned.
Yeah.
The Asperger's thing has been troubling to me in the sense that when he learns that the recommendation is going to be disbarment, which is before the hearing, given the fact that he has Asperger's, and he described his inability with social skills in a response to Mr. Rapp's interrogation, he was upset, clearly was upset. Well, I can tell you from dealing with lots of lawyers who don't have any problems, that when their livelihood is threatened and it looks like they may be facing the possibility of suspension, they get upset. They're not very rational. It's a different horse when you're the one that's in the middle of it and not somebody else. I can only tell you I can't make any vouch safe for Mr. Henry, other than to say there's nothing that suggests he's done anything since then that would call into question his ability to control himself. I'm in a situation that it just is amazing to me that we start with this vague as possible thing, then we're going to clean it up with something and conform it to the evidence. That
your,
to me,
your time is up.
That to me indicates a thought that we're going to think outside the box on how we deal with ethical issues. In my judgment, that is not the thing we want to do, think outside the box.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me address first, if I may, the references to a vague information. The voicemails were left well into this case, just a couple of weeks before this case went to hearing. The reason
and there was a statement made that they weren't admitted in evidence. Your brief says
the voicemails were admitted into evidence. The emails, I think, that you directed to Ms. Applequist were not admitted into evidence. Understand that it was notice pleading. It was somewhat vague, but for goodness sakes, he knows exactly what he did. It wasn't vague when it came to the violations. It talked to the information, which is in the record, in the appendix, talks about the violations, the specific rules that are alleged to have been violated. What it doesn't use are the actual racist words that the assignment used, and because it was not necessary. He knew exactly what he had done. There was no need to advise him of that. Everyone's going to see it. So the vague information or conforming the evidence to the information was simply as to those voicemails. A remorse. Yes, he sent a remorseful letter of apology where he admitted he had poor character, a moral character, to Judge Gaitan. But you should know, as the panel points out in its decision at page 9, paragraph 2, that he attempted at the hearing to say he didn't know Judge Gaitan's race when he sent that email. So if that's admission of remorsefulness, I would say I doubt that. And the panel found that not to be credible, that he did not know Judge Gaitan's race. Finally, this is, I think what, again, sets this case apart is the anti-discrimination rule violation, 8.4G. If this were simply an attorney that called a judge a puppet or called a judge an idiot, we'd be able to say, yes, this fits well into Madison and Westfall. But what sets this case apart is he's not accusing the judge of being racist. It shows his racism. It shows that he's a racist. And the question becomes for this court, do you want someone to hold a license in this state who expresses that kind of opinion regarding the judiciary, a member of the courts in this state? I would say that it is a gross and severe case of misconduct, as Mr. Russell states, is the standard for disbarment, and it calls for disbarment in this case.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.